The CDC says that between 1992 and 2008, 155 commercial fishermen died after falling overboard, making commercial fishing among America's most dangerous jobs. Our Sunday morning cover story is from Jim Axelrod.
John Aldridge and Anthony Szczynski, best buddies since second grade, are co-owners of the Anna Mary, a 44-foot fishing boat. For the last 14 years, they've pulled up lobsters and crabs from the sea floor off the coast of Montauk, Long Island.
It's like, oh, we got food, we got fuel, the boat's running right, we're off on another adventure.
But these two hardy lobstermen could have done with a little less adventure one July evening 4 years ago. 40 miles offshore at 2:30 in the morning, Anthony asleep below deck. John wanted to fill the tanks where they would soon store their catch.
And I had to move the cooler off the hatch.
A 125-pound cooler sat on top of the tank's hatch.
Come back here, and I...
John picked up a metal hook to move it.
And I put it in the handle here, and I pulled with all my might. And when I did, it just snapped. And the momentum just pushed me right out the back of the boat.
The boat was on automatic pilot, and John, wearing no life vest, watched helplessly as the Anna Mary motored away.
I could see the boat, but then I come down on in the wave, and I couldn't see the boat, and then come up on the crest, and then you see it, and then it's gone.
Were you screaming for Anthony?
Screaming, but knowing that there's no way he's going to hear me.
You know.
You know, you're done. Today's the day I'm going to die.
With his mind consumed by impending death, some instinctive part of John Aldridge stayed focused on life.
What'd you do?
I realized that my boots were very buoyant.
They're just like a life preserver?
Well, when I fell in the water, I was on my back and I was doing like this, you know, trying to stay afloat. My legs came up to the surface. I just clicked, all right, that's a sign right there. I got my breath and I go, wow, maybe I should just empty the water out of the thing and push it back in the water with some air pocket in it and see what it does. And I did that and I tested and I go, wow. And I basically took it and put it under my arm.
John, that is crazy fast thinking.
You gotta think quick or you die.
Afloat in the moonlit water, John Aldridge turned his focus to the next pressing issue the ocean provided.
And you're sitting there and you're spinning and you're trying to, is something coming around me? You know, you don't know, you're freaking out. 15 feet away, I see two shark fins come up. And I'm like, this is not getting, this is not real.
You saw two shark fins?
Yeah. So I had to come into this whole little mantra in my head of breathe, breathe easy, stop panicking, just go with the thing. And then not focus on that they're right there.
Staying calm worked. The shark swam off.
Who are you thinking of?
I'm thinking of my family. I'm thinking that nobody in the world knows I'm missing.
4 hours later, Anthony woke up in his bunk and could not find John.
I was in disbelief, straight up disbelief. He can't be not here.
U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Coast Guard, Anna Mary.
He radioed the Coast Guard.
Anna Mary, this is Coast Guard on 16, go ahead.
I lost the crew member overboard. I'm in shock.
I never thought that he was dead. Right now he's alive, and we're looking for him.
At the Coast Guard station in New Haven, Connecticut, Commander John Thiel was in charge.
If I give you truth serum, you're not betting that you're going to find this guy.
My fear is we're not going to find anything. To
go to sleep. Immediately, he put search and rescue protocols in place.
We have all kinds of inputs that we put in there as far as how tall he is, whether he was wearing a flotation device or not, what the winds are doing, the currents. It just mathematically spits out anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 computations.
So each one of these dots could be John Aldridge.
The computer produced a zone of probability where Aldridge would most likely be. It was roughly the size of Rhode Island.
How could you possibly search an area the size of Rhode Island and find him?
We train our people of what to look for. We talk about either a coconut or a basketball floating on the water, which is incredibly hard.
On board the Anna Mary, a critical clue. Anthony found the busted off cooler handle, helping the Coast Guard and a volunteer fleet of fishing boats narrow the search.
Different fishing friends out on the ocean started calling me, asking me where I was.
And he's talking to fishermen about, well, it doesn't make sense. We shouldn't have filled the tanks until the 40-fathom curve.
When the Anna Mary reached a depth of 40 fathoms, or 240 feet, that was when John and Anthony would start filling those tanks.
John was likely moving the cooler. Probably the handle broke.
You've got that kind of detective work going on?
I kept setting goals for myself. I said, I just gotta live till morning.
Back in the water, the sun was coming up.
After a little while, I come up on a swell and I see a buoy way in the distance.
It was just what John needed, a shot of hope when his supply had nearly run out.
Helicopters are going by to the west of me.
And you're waving, you're yelling?
All of it, but I know they're too far away to even see me.
With those boots keeping him afloat, Aldridge made it to that buoy and hung on for his life.
And I guess within about 40 minutes later, all of a sudden it's like, here comes this helicopter. Big, giant thing over the sky. And I start flailing my boots and splashing and waving and everything. And then all of a sudden that thing turns over the top of me, and then I know, oh my God, I'm saved. Unbelievable, you know, you can't believe, wow, I am gonna be saved.
Coast Guard swimmer Bob Hovey was lowered into the water and helped John into the basket. 12 hours after he fell into the Atlantic Ocean, sure he was a dead man, John Aldridge was safe.
The pilot put his visor back, looked back at me, and he goes, man, you got some will to live. And I said, I got a lot of people that love me to die like that. And he goes, man, you're one tough dude. You know, he goes, we don't find live people, we find bodies.
After the rescue, John didn't see Bob Hovey again.
Damn.
Mr. Aldridge.
Wow.
Until we brought them together on the dock in Montauk.
Good to see you, man.
Good to see you.
Wow.
What do you remember about the moment of making contact with him in the water?
His charisma. When I approached him in the water, I told him how long we had been looking for him.
And that's when he said, holy cow, we've been looking for you for 9 hours today, you know? And I said, well, I've been looking for you for 12.
A lot of little things.
Today, the Coast Guard uses the Aldridge rescue as a teaching tool.
It's nice when it all goes right.
It's nice when it works out.
Kathy, how are you?
Hi.
John's sister Kathy was also there when we brought the two together.
Thank you so much for saving my brother.
You're very welcome.
John Aldridge's ordeal and miraculous outcome have turned into a new book, a movie deal, and a lot of treasured souvenirs.
This is the actual handle that had snapped that Anthony found on the back deck of the boat.
None more treasured than those boots.
They saved your life.
These are the ones that saved my life.
Is there a lesson that people hearing your story should learn from what happened to you?
Well, positive thinking saved my life. If I didn't have positive thinking and those boots, I would have never made it.
Positive thinking and those boots.
Yeah.
You all know I'm a sucker for human interest stories. I came across this story in preparing this sermon, and we're going through Advent. And Advent is a time where we kind of slow down as a church, and it's not just High Plains Harvest. The Advent season has been in the calendar of the Reformed Church for a long time. And there are typically traditional topics that are covered during Advent. Last week, Mike talked about faith, the crisis of faith. Today, we're going to talk about hope. And so let me start with a question. What is hope in your life? For some, hope is when the power goes out at the house, the first candle that's lit. Hope may be the first day you wake up and you can finally breathe again after a terrible cold or flu or something. Maybe hope is that percentage that you're given that you have the chance of beating cancer. Maybe hope is that really faint line on that stick when you've been struggling to get pregnant. Or maybe it's that first ray of sunshine after you've been up all night, after a tearful, nightmare-filled night. Hope is the first soldier to hit the beach in that liberation. Hope is hearing the words, "He's going to be okay." Hope was that flicker of maybe, just maybe. Hope, I believe, is what fuels faith. And hope is what we celebrate during Advent. So what exactly is Advent? Well, for some, the concept may be new. If you didn't grow up in the church, I did. My wife, Stephanie, did as well. We grew up in the Lutheran church, and so Advent was a very pomp and circumstance sort of a season, right? There was this gigantic wreath with these five different candles, and every Sunday the new candle was lit. Maybe you remember Advent like I do from a little calendar that was on the wall, and each day you would open a little window, and there would be a new picture in there. Or maybe you each day opened up a window, and there was some sort of gift or treat that you got. And this all led up to Christmas. But Advent is much, much more than that. The word in Latin means coming or arrival. It's a season that's marked by expectation, by waiting, by anticipation, longing. And Advent is not just a kind of like a pre-Christmas or an extension of Christmas. It's really a season that links us together with the past, the present, and the future. Advent offers us the opportunity to share in the historical longing of the coming Messiah. For many months, we've been in the book of Exodus, and we're starting to get a taste in that book of this, even more so of this coming Messiah for the Israelites. But it's also a time where we get to celebrate his birth, and we also get to anticipate his second coming. Advent looks back upon Christ's coming in celebration, in thanks, in gratitude. But at the same time, we look forward with that same eager expectation of the coming of Christ's kingdom, and that when he returns for his people, hope is fulfilled in Jesus and him coming. But the hope is also still to be completed in his second coming. As part of the church calendar in many denominations, there are different ways that people celebrate Advent. But at the core, regardless of the traditions or the practices, at the core, the principle is still the same. Now, are Christians required to observe Advent? No, absolutely not. It's not in the Bible. Does observing Advent make you a better Christian? Does it make you more acceptable to God? No. But can celebrating Advent be a good reminder of what this season is truly about? I would say yes, and I would also submit to you that this is where the greatest value of Advent is. Typically, Christmas is a season that's full of crazy busyness. But Advent is a time for us to, like I said, slow down, step back from the trees, see what's really going on, and prepare our hearts and help us place a focus on a story that is far greater than us. It's not a season of pretending or covering up or putting on some Christian facade. We got our Christmas tree yesterday. It's a traditional time. We went to the Christmas tree lot just out north of Fort Collins. We've gone there for 17 years. The young man came up to me and said, "Hey, is this your first time here?" And I said, "No, we've come here for 17 years. In fact, we used to come when your lot was down the road and it was an honor pay lot. There wasn't any people there." And so we can get caught up in the busyness. But even in decorating the tree last night, I watched Stephanie as she has these massive boxes full of all these different Christmas ornaments. Our house isn't big enough to put a tree in to put all of those ornaments on. And so what does she do? She very selectively goes through and looks at every single ornament in the box and picks out ones that have meaning. It's easy for us to get caught up in the busyness of the season. And it's easy for us to lose sight that God did all of this for his redeeming love for our world. He wasn't covering up. He wasn't pretending. This is a season of digging into the reality of what God has done in sending his own son into the world. It's a season of expectation and preparation, and it's an opportunity, I think, to align ourselves with God's presence. Not so much the presence under the tree, but God's presence. So wherever you are on your own spiritual journey, this church would invite you into this season as a time that would allow you to ask questions, to doubt, to struggle. But as we're doing that, we're taking time to prepare our hearts for Christ's coming. As we examine these key aspects of Christmas over the next few weeks, our prayer is that we discover together in a deeper way that we can trust in Emmanuel. Like Mike said earlier, God with us. He is bigger than our greatest expectations, our deepest pains. His light shines into every corner crevice of darkness. And he's calling us all the time to draw nearer to him, closer and closer. He didn't sit up in heaven and demand that we work our way to him. He loved us so much that he stepped off his throne and he came down to meet us in our place. As we go through the season, we discover that and realize that God brings the gifts. He brings the gifts to us. And even as he does that, we discover him. So today we're going to focus on hope. So let's start at looking at what do we mean by hope? So very practical question. What statements do you typically hear people say that involve hope? I hope it doesn't rain. I hope it doesn't snow. I hope the wind is not so bad that we get drifted in, and for the first time in 10 years, or third time in 10 years, I physically can't make it to church. I hope I get that job. I hope this world would be at peace. I hope he gets better. I hope she shows up. I hope I win the lottery. I hope you fill in the blank. Do you notice a common theme in all of those statements? Worldly hope is characterized by doubt. There's uncertainty. There's a lack of control. We hope for things that may or may not happen. But in Jesus, hope is a guarantee. It's for sure. Our hope as Christians is actually, I know so, instead of, well, maybe so. And the hope that we have in Jesus is a hope past, a hope present, and a hope future. Advent is not a celebration of God coming to fix things, to fix the broken computer, or to fix a broken family, or fix broken or hurting lives. Advent is simply a celebration that God comes. God comes to be with us. He is Emmanuel. He is God with us. In all of our darkness, in all of our pain, in the chaos, whatever's going on in our life, he came. And he made a way. There's a long journey of hope. And that's the way, though, that God has been working throughout all of history. Remember back in the beginning, when in the way God intended his creation, what did he do? He walked freely with Adam and Eve. He walked with us. And humanity enjoyed wholeness, completeness, and intimacy with God. But as Paul Harvey used to say, we know the rest of the story. Adam and Eve chose sin, and separation divided God and humans. The brokenness of our world that we know far too well is the ongoing result, and that's what we experience today. But do you realize, think about this, that ever since that happened, God has been working tirelessly towards restoration and healing and wholeness again for us. This is the overall story of the Bible. Throughout the whole Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, we can see God making a way and giving and reminding his people of hope. That he is still at work. We see it all the way back in Genesis, in God's covenant with Abraham. Genesis 12, verse 3, he said, "And in you all the families of the earth will be blessed." When God encountered Jacob at Bethel, he renewed that covenant again, and he reinforced the hope rooted in his faithfulness. Genesis 18, he said, "Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." But then a lot of time passed, years and generations, and we humans, frankly, honestly, if we're honest with ourselves, we're extremely impatient, an extremely impatient animal. "How long, O God," is what the Israelites said. That's what they cried out. And from the times of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, Elijah, Elisha, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and all the other prophets, we see this repeating history of devotion to God and then non-devotion, neglect of God. There was prosperity, and then there was recession. There was feast, and then there was actual literal famine. There was pleasure, and there was pain. The Hebrew people were not really any different than us. When things got good, they tended to forget about God. And then when things got bad, that's when they cried out to God to help them. But all through it all, there was this deep longing for God to fulfill his covenant, his promise of a Messiah who would come and make everything right. And this wasn't just some happy idea that kind of floated in and out of the Israelites' mind. It was a deep hope. It was actually probably their deepest hope. And it sustained them and encouraged them and it spurred them on through thousands of years. In the midst of that long journey of hope, Isaiah, which most biblical scholars would call him a major prophet, Which is kind of interesting because when it talks about minor and major prophets, it's really the length of a book, I think. Like if you write a big book, like Isaiah, you're a major prophet. You write a small book, you're a minor prophet. I'm not sure how that works. But anyway, but Isaiah wrote and taught a lot, and he played a very prominent role in Israel. He was an extremely famous guy in his day, but he wasn't always that popular, especially when he was telling kings and the people things that they didn't want to hear. Like, God doesn't like how you're cheating the poor. Or an enemy empire is going to come and invade your country. You might say, I think it's right to say, that Isaiah is sort of a poster prophet for Advent. This season of longing, of expecting, of hoping that God would be with us. Through Isaiah, God gave Israel and us many prophecies and promises about the Messiah. So in a sense, Isaiah was a prophet of hope. You probably know many of these teachings, actually. You may not know that you know many of these teachings. But scripture from the book of Isaiah is very popular around Christmas. In fact, many passages from Isaiah are the lyrics for George Frederick Handel's Messiah. Written in 1741, Handel's Messiah has lasted for centuries. It's part of our Christian tradition. I think it's because of its beauty, of its complexity, of its truth. Because it's a moving soundtrack of hope, regardless of what musical style you like. Listen to it. It's full of hope. See, Isaiah lived 700 years before Jesus, but he gave us incredibly beautiful words that ring with hope about the coming Messiah. Here are some of them. Isaiah 7:14. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will be with child and bear a son, and she will call his name Emmanuel. A little bit later in 9. But there will be no more gloom for her who is in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt. But later on, he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. And a little later in the same chapter, Isaiah wrote, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. There will be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish this. So imagine yourself living back then, in a day with no digital communications and very little written information, actually, at the time. How would you take hearing a message like that? Can you imagine the hope that was instilled, that would spring up in people's hearts? People ask all the time, did Isaiah understand all of these messages and these promises? I think on some level, yes. But I think on others, probably not. He certainly didn't know God's timeline. He didn't know when all of this would happen, when the Messiah would come. Maybe Isaiah thought that it would happen inside of his lifetime. Or maybe he was just wise enough to know that God's work would stretch from generation to generation. But we do know this. Isaiah was filled with hope. And God's promises fueled him. And it fueled the people. Because we see them continuing for years and years, actually centuries. Isaiah's vision of God with us still fuels our hope today, a millennia later. So as we turn our attention to the Christmas narrative in Luke again, Zechariah would have been well acquainted with all of the words and all the prophecies of Isaiah. Zechariah was a priest. He was very well schooled. In fact, Luke describes him as a righteous and blameless man. He was a good Jewish follower of God, and he was a spiritual leader of his people. And no doubt he held deep longings for the Messiah who had been promised. But Zechariah was still in shock when suddenly, out of the blue, just a regular, ordinary day when he's out doing his priestly things, God drops this mega dose of hope into his world and the people of Israel's as well. So, I mean, picture this. It's been 400 years since Israel has had any clear prophetic message from God. 400 years was the silence. Think about how long that is. I did a quick Google search. The United States today is only 243 years old. So to give us a comparison, right, about 400 years ago, Jonas Kepler, the famous scientist, was just discovering the planetary laws. North America had yet to be explored by the Europeans. The very first ship, 243 years ago, actually it was 1619 is when it happened. The first ship arrived in Virginia carrying human cargo, African slaves. Jamestown had just been settled, and Henry Hudson had just discovered the Hudson Bay. So a long, long time ago, with a whole lot of lives that have come and gone in between them, but it's close enough in time that I think that things are recognizable for us. So this angel shows up, and he tells Zechariah that he would have a son, who it says in Luke 1, who will go as a forerunner before him in the spirit and the power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the fathers back to the children and the disobedient to the attitude of the righteous so as to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. See, Zechariah knew the significance. He knew that his son, John the Baptist, was a fulfillment of the prophecies of the Messiah. He also knew that this was a miraculous occurrence. But understand also that Zechariah and his wife Elizabeth, they were old. They were too old to have kids. And this was a big deal for them because back in those times, it was a shameful thing to not have children, especially to a woman, not to be able to have kids. Zechariah and Elizabeth, they wanted to have children. They hoped and they prayed to God to bless them with children. But it never happened for them. They were very well thought of in the community, especially Zacharias. Zechariah, he was a good priest, he was called. But the fact that they were childless left a stigma on them. There was an asterisk, basically, in people's minds. You know, the people might say, oh, yeah, you know Zechariah and Elizabeth. Oh, they're really good people, but they don't have any children. That's such a shame. So when Zechariah receives this message from the angel, at least he was in shock, at a minimum. And he couldn't quite get over this part about him and his wife having a child. I don't even know what he was thinking, but it had to be something along the lines of, me? Are you kidding me? That's not possible. And as a result, Mike talked about last week, God decided to make Zechariah speechless until his son was born. Now, this was certainly an inconvenience, but you can imagine the hope that sprang up in this couple and all the people around them when they heard this news, because what's happening? The old prophecies are being fulfilled. The one that was prophesied to come in the spirit of Elijah to prepare the way for the Messiah, he's coming. It's not someday. This is happening. God is moving to restore hope, and he's still here. God is stirring things up, and he's literally changing eternity forever. Do we go into Advent, do we go into Christmas thinking that way? That God was changing eternity forever. Certainly in Israel, the hope was alive again. But as we step back from the trees and we look at the whole forest, realize that hope on earth is alive again for everyone. So some of you might be thinking, well, that's all great and nice and everything for people, you know, thousands of years ago. But what about for us? What about for me? I mean, they weren't fighting cancer. Their spouse wasn't killed fighting a war on the other side of the world. They didn't lose their job with no warning and couldn't pay bills. The debts are stacking up or can't put food on the table. And what about the kids who are expecting Christmas presents? Church family, no matter what kind of problems and struggles you are facing right now, no matter what place of darkness or pain that you are in, let me encourage you, like John Aldrich, don't abandon hope. Even in our deepest places, hope is alive because Emmanuel, God is with us. How can we know this? How can we find that tiny spark of hope when we're on the verge of giving up? I think there are several ways that any one of us can ignite and reconnect with God during this Advent season, no matter what kind of circumstances we're facing. The first is that we have hope based on God's word. Part of God with us, part of Emmanuel, is the written word that he has left us. These are the promises that he has made to his people. Not just to his people Israel, but to his people, you, us, today, the church. They are a piece of him. They are beacons of hope. They are reminders that can penetrate through the circumstances into our hearts, into our spirits, and assure us that no matter what we are facing, no matter how bleak tomorrow looks, how bad the pain might be, God will never leave us, and he'll never forsake us. And nothing can separate us from him. Listen to the words that he wrote in Psalm 139. Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. Do you hear the hope in that? Right? Can you hear in those words, we are not alone. God with us means that he is always with us, no matter what, and nothing can take that away. Scripture is filled with stories and words and promises that rekindle this supernatural hope within us. And as we move through Advent, I want to encourage you to dig into those words of the Bible and dig in expectantly. Expect to find the glory of God. Expect to find the hope of God, because they're there. Because God is with us, We can take that hope that we are never alone, that he's always working in and amongst us, but understand that he's not done yet. He's not done with his greatest and final work of completely healing you. The second way we can rekindle hope, I think, is to put our focus on God's character, on who he is and the promises that he makes. There's a story, I won't read through the whole thing, but it's in Mark, I think I put it in your sermon notes, Mark chapter 5, starts at verse 25. And it's kind of an easy story to kind of overlook or glance over, but it's a great story of hope. It's a story about a woman. We don't know her name, but we see this bold hope in her. We're told that for 12 years, the woman had been bleeding. And no one was able to help her. The doctors have tried to help her, but her condition just keeps getting worse and worse. And it was a condition that would have affected everything about her, her everyday life and everything that she did. Those of you with long-term illness or chronic pain know exactly what I'm talking about. The woman was probably considered unclean and would be an outcast. But even people who might try to understand her problem really couldn't. She actually didn't really understand the problem herself. But she heard about this man named Jesus. And she heard the stories and the miracles and the healings, and she believed. Hope awoke in her. The hope of healing, the hope of new life. And that hope drove her to action. She must have thought, if I can just get close enough to touch his clothes, it says, I'll be healed. If this Jesus is who he actually says he is, then he can heal me. It was a bold hope that she had. And it may seem like a really small action to us, but she did what she could do just to get close enough to Jesus, just to reach out and touch him. And when she did, it changed her whole world. Was it hard for her? I'm sure it was. Working your way through this big, noisy, crowded crowd, it had to be difficult. I mean, she has this long-term illness. I mean, she's stigmatized by society. She's looked down upon. I'm sure that she was afraid. Especially after she touched him, Jesus begins looking for her in this crowd of people. Who touched me? Jesus asked. Which is kind of ironic because he's God and he's all-knowing, right? He knows exactly who touched her, right? But it's a teaching moment. The disciples say, what do you mean, who touched me? We're in the middle of this crowd. I can only imagine that woman just being frozen at that moment. On one hand, she knows that she's just been miraculously healed. But on the other, is she about to pay for touching Jesus? And she fessed up, it was me. I'm sure she said it very timidly and fearfully as well. But what did Jesus do? Jesus connected with her very deeply and directly. Emmanuel, God with us. And the healing, the peace, and the now freedom that she had completely changed her life. Church family, this is our God. This is his character. Jesus is worthy. He was and still is Emmanuel, God with us. He fulfilled Israel's hope for the Messiah when he arrived on that first Christmas. And we're pretty sure that Jesus wasn't born on December 25th, right? Maybe it was in the spring. Maybe it was late spring. Maybe, you know, we don't really know for sure. But regardless, Jesus fulfilled all of humanity's hopes for victory, victory over death. And then he puts an exclamation point on it, right, when he's resurrected on that first Easter. And know this, one day he will ultimately fulfill all hope, and he will complete God's work of total restoration of all creation. That's the promise that he left with us. And he gives us a foundation of confidence and boldness. We talked a few weeks ago about Matthew 28. When he made this promise, I am with you always to the very end of the age. He ain't going anywhere. Emmanuel. And this is a promise worthy to fuel our hope, to fuel our faith. Because God is true to his character. And because of who God is, for that reason alone, we can take hope in him. The third way we can find hope is by focusing on God's faithfulness. Think back, how has God worked in your life? What are those moments or those memories where you have experienced God's work in your life? You know those times when you had no doubt that he was there. He was working. Maybe it's been recently. Maybe it's a long, long time ago. But in those circumstances that were swirling around you, you know that God's presence, that he was with you. So what does that have to do with hope? What do these memories have to do with our here and now? Let me submit to you that gratitude breeds hope. And I must confess, I didn't come up with that myself. Somebody much smarter than me. Gratitude breeds hope. Thankfulness fosters hope. And acknowledgement and appreciation bring hope. Listen to the words from the prophet Jeremiah, found in the book of Lamentations. Lamentations is probably not a book that any one of us spend a whole lot of time reading, but there's some good stuff in here. Lamentations 3, this I recall to my mind, therefore I have hope. The Lord's loving kindness indeed never cease, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I have hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, to the person who seeks him. It is good that he awaits silently for the salvation of the Lord. Go back to the very first one, if you would. Did you catch this? This I recall to my mind, therefore I have hope. Jeremiah understood that there's hope in the future when we remember what God has done in the past. He knew that hope sparks like a fire. It flows like water. It grows like a seed. Hope grows and it spreads like a living thing. Yeah, there are times that hope can waver. It can dwindle. And yes, even sometimes hope dies. But if we nurture and care for it, if we keep remembering what God has done, it can be revived, it can flourish, and it can multiply. I think focusing on gratitude can renew and grow our hope. When we recognize and appreciate that God has shown us in the past what he has shown us, that increases our hope for what he's going to do in the future. And sharing this gratitude and hope with those who love us, those who support us, those who are around us, with our brothers and sisters, it's like a force multiplier. Hope spreads. Hope grows. Hope is alive, and we need to nurture this living hope, and it will sustain us through the darkest days, even as we wait for God to move. So John Aldridge made it alive to the next morning. And he tried to keep his hope alive. But as the hours kept passing by, and he saw the boat disappear. The hope was declining. And then finally, what did he do? He spotted a fishing buoy. And he was able to reach it and climb onto it. There was a new surge of hope. I'm a firm believer that God puts buoys in our lives. Something that we can hang on to keep us. One of the things that, and if you're interested, you see me afterwards, I can give you the link to the full New York Times article on this. It's, 10, 12 pages long. It's an amazing story. What they didn't say in the video is that when he found that first buoy, he would hold on to the, it was too big for him to actually get on top of. So he would hang on to the bottom of it. The problem was that buoy is attached to lobster traps down on the ocean floor. And when the swell would go up, the buoy would go underwater. And he would have to go underwater with it. It wasn't until he found a second buoy and he took his pocket knife out and tied the two buoys together and straddled the rope was he able to actually stay on top of the water to see the Coast Guard helicopters and the Anna Mary passing by. God gives us buoys. Maybe it's a friend. Maybe it's a family member. Maybe you're supposed to be that buoy. This last week at my job, there was an individual who had to be banned from the business, from ever coming into the business ever again. An older man, a veteran, who was struggling with some serious long-term and terminal illness. And I ran out and I met him in the parking lot. And I just said, hey, can we have coffee once a week from here on out? Maybe you're supposed to be the buoy that somebody gets to hang on to. Maybe you're supposed to be the buoy that speaks that little bit of God's truth into that person's life. Maybe you need a buoy and it's there. You just got to grab onto it and wait for that helicopter to fly by. After a while, the Coast Guard helicopter flew by and spotted John waving and splashing. And I love what he said. They pulled him up to safety. The diver said, we've been looking for you for 9 hours. And he said, yeah, that's funny. I've been looking for you for 12. This is an amazing story. And this is so true to our lives. God is searching for you. If you are not a Christian here this morning, God has been searching for you for more than 9 hours. And if you are a Christian this morning, praise God and know that he came out and looked for you. And it wasn't the size of Rhode Island that he was looking for you. It was the universe. And he found you and he put you in that basket and pulled you up into that helicopter. Because just like John Aldridge, you have more in this life to do than you even realize. And you have people that love you. It's an amazing story, but the center of it is hope. If it were most of us out there bobbing around in the middle of the ocean, like the officer said, you know, a coconut or a basketball, we probably would have given up hope that there was even a chance, even a sliver of a chance to survive. But that is exactly how hope is. Hope is a whisper that maybe, just maybe, these boots are going to float me enough, long enough, that somebody will find me. He said that in the article, again, not in the video, but in the article, that he at one point he just tied himself off to the buoy, thinking that at least his family would have a body to find. They would have a body to bury. But hope is that whisper that God is with us. And he wants us in a deep, intimate relationship with him. And he proved it because he sent a wonderful, perfect Savior, whose name is Jesus. So what is hope in your life? Let me just close with one final verse, Romans 15:13. Now may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, so that you will abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. Amen.